Kristen Brody. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to 89.7 Boston Public Radio at WGBH.
Hello there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So how many of you out there know who Joseph Timmelty is? Now, if you don't feel bad about your civic engagement. You can blame that one on the Red Sox. As the Globe's front page story by Andrew Ryan reminds us this morning, in 1975, Joe Timmelty fought hard to unseat Kevin White in the Boston mayoral race. But instead, he was competing against the Red Sox. That year, of course, the Red Sox played deep into October, going to the seventh game of the World Series. So could the same thing be said to John Connolly and Marty Walsh? Are the Red Sox dwarfing the mayoral race and, frankly, everything else during their playoff run? Our number is 877-301-8970. Essentially, is the focus there, and you're not a huge baseball fan. I'm a huge baseball fan,
right?
Even though my first love is my hometown team, the Phillies. The Red Sox are a close second. If they were in the World Series, I don't know what I would do if they played against each other. But it is true. It takes over everything. And by the way, they may say football is the biggest sport in America. Everybody loves Tom Brady. Everybody loves the Patriots. The Red Sox, when they are on fire, the city is laser-like focused on that and nothing else.
Well, there were some great little numbers in remarks in Andrew Ryan's piece in the Globe today. Number one, that was sort of depressing for the candidates, 979,500 viewers of the Red Sox game.
Million people, yeah.
52,000 for the mayoral debate. Actually, that wasn't that bad. 52,000.
No, it's not at all, but it's 20-1, Archery. I mean, that's the part that's
20-1. I did not know this. You know, the first pitch ever thrown out at Fenway came from the right arm of former Boston politician and mayor John Honey Fitzgerald.
It was like 100 years ago. I think it's 100 years
old. I did not know that. But they point out, and this is good for the candidates, that everybody feels better about Boston when the Red Sox are winning. They go into these different venues, John Connolly and Marty Walsh, to meet people. Everyone's in a better mood. They're not so hostile. They might not slam the door in their face. Connolly makes a good point, though. You do not want to do any phone banking during a Red Sox game, and you do not want to, by all means, knock on anybody's door when the Red Sox are playing.
Yeah, but that's a very thin read. To argue that people are friendlier, which I know John Connolly or Marty Walsh or one of them said in the piece, is fine. Even the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, was with us on Wednesday. He admitted he was watching the Red Sox game at the same time the mayoral debate, sponsored by the Boston Globe or co-sponsored by them, was going on. Listen to Brian.
The editor sticks to the baseball game for the last couple of innings.
Truth will set you free, Brian.
I love it. You are an honest man.
Now, let me clarify. I went back and forth. Because everybody went back and forth. I mean, what are you supposed to do here? It was an unfortunate situation. Look, the owner of the Red Sox is about to be our owner in a week.
That's a good point.
Fine watching the baseball game. You know?
But even if you don't work for an entity where John Henry is your boss, I love it, by the way. It's all-consuming
in
a way.
Well, it's not all-consuming.
Yes, it is.
It's not all-consuming, and I think that's another good point here. There are some of us, like myself, who are sort of out of it in the baseball front, even though I used to live so close to Fenway, I could hear the people screaming, you know, back when they won the World Series. Yes, you could take the dog for a walk and you can hear the roar of the crowd from Fenway Park. That was pretty neat. I could even walk to the stadium back when you used to be able to buy tickets on the game day. I guess you could do a little bit of that before they had their return to glory this year. But anyway, you know, not everybody's into it. So there are some people, maybe we're losers,
You are outliers,
that are just not swept up in Red Sox mania.
Would you agree for the vast majority of people in greater Boston, the Red Sox are the thing? I mean, they really are.
They are, or you pretend they're the thing. You're one of those pink hat people, the ones that, you know, they go to Fenway Park and they come out and they're not sure, you know, how many strikes are in the ball.
Yeah, but they're into it in the moment, even if they're fans
how
only of the moment.
How many downs are in an inning?
Exactly. 877-301-8970. Which side are you on in this thing? Are you one of those people for whom the Red Sox playoff run is basically pushing everything aside, including a mayoral election that is only, how many days now? I think it's 18 days away. Our debate, of course, on WGBH is next Tuesday. Or are you one of those people like Marjorie who suggests that life goes on? I just think that is not the case. You know, I've lived in, I would argue, maybe other than St. Louis, the three most fan-frenzied baseball cities in the United States. I grew up in Philadelphia for 21 years. Then I moved to New York. I lived there 15 years. Now I live here. There are no cities where people are more into their baseball team than those, but there is nothing that compares to the Red Sox and people's connection to the Red Sox. And I think, you, by the way, you're painting yourself as sort of a casual fan who is not consumed by it. I think most casual fans are totally consumed by this. You notice the weather is nicer, by the way?
I get excited when I actually go to the game. I mean, there's nothing better than sitting out in Fenway Park, you know, in a cool, crisp October night, or even better, in the summer when it's July and it's kind of hot and steamy and everybody's there. And you know,
the
a couple
World
of times,
Series isn't in July.
A couple of
often.
Times. I know, but July is a great time to be at Fenway Park. Great. And a couple of times I have been to the game with Jim, and seventh inning stretch is always a challenge for you.
It's hard getting out of the chair. They're very tight. Well, we should say what happened. A couple of years ago during the 2007 playoff run, we were on another radio station. Mm-hmm. We were complaining. We were probably the only on-air people in Boston
Losers.
Who did not have tickets to the
Losers.
Playoffs. And Bob Sheridan, then the head of SBLI, called us on the phone and out of pity gave us two tickets down the first baseline. We went. It was unbelievable. It was
right
during the playoff
thing.
The problem was, it is true, during the seventh inning, because I'm rather large, it was without the olive oil spray that you brought with you, I would not have been able to get out of my seat.
It was Pam. It was Pam
for baking.
Whatever it was. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Do you feel as though Red Sox fever has subsumed everything in Boston? No one cares about anything except the Red Sox.
Do you think the average person...
I don't subscribe to that theory because I'm not that swept up.
Do you think the average person in Boston is more into the Red Sox or more into what is a very competitive race between two really talented men,
well,
the mayor race of Boston? Which do you think?
The Red Sox, much more. Well, that's where I take issue with Andrew Ryan. He talks about Boston as a city obsessed with sports and politics. We are obsessed with sports. I don't think we're obsessed with
politics.
Well,
we used to
anymore.
Be. When I first moved here.
Yeah, when James Michael Curley was the mayor a million years ago.
10, 15 years ago, politics was the sport of Boston. I'm not saying baseball was not huge. Politics has taken a backseat, even in normal times.
Total backseat.
But particularly in these times. And again, you have a race that is a virtual dead heat. The two polls have Connolly up, 7 and 8 points, which is not quite within the margin of error. But every expert with whom either of us speaks says this is going to come down to the wire. I happen to buy into that. There are two more televised debates, one with us next week, and
That's
then
right.
the consortium debate.
It's next Tuesday.
I know it is.
At 7 o'clock.
It is.
Just
it's good.
In case
you should try to be
know.
There. But I am telling you that you are out of the mainstream. We'll take calls and see which side people are on in this. 877-301-8970. And just to get you in the mood, Marjorie says, you know, so. Here is a Red Sox player, Mike Napoli, last night, hitting a home run that was apparently 450 feet, which is colossal or something. And tell me this doesn't divert you from all other things worldly. Here it is.
Facing this good right-hander for the Tigers. As Napoli hits one into center. Back at the wall, the Red Sox lead it on a blast to center by Mike Napoli. It's 1-0.
Now that gets my juices going. How about yours?
I was watching an in-depth discussion of the government shutdown on CNN. Can't get enough of Anderson Cooper.
Okay, let's take some calls. Let's start in Bedford. Ivan, you are on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Ivan. How are you?
Hey, Jim. Your name is Big Poppy and Margaret is Big Mommy.
Thank you.
Where are you on this, Ivan?
Man, what mayor race? What are you talking about?
Okay.
This is the way it should be because baseball is different. Baseball is like life. It's long, tedious, sometimes exciting. And Boston is a great city because we follow traditions. We follow, it's got a sense of history, and this team represents us. I mean, these guys look like us. They got big asses, you know. They got big
they horrible got big beards.
Beards. Horrible beards. What do you think of the beards, Ivan? I mean, come on. They look a little ridiculous.
I love it.
You can
recycle your first bite. You can eat it once, and then you can lick the leftovers, you know?
Ivan, you have said it better than anybody could. Thank you for your call. And since Ivan mentioned the beards, by the way, which are the foulest-looking things I've ever seen, you know, they mic'd the umpire. Edgar B. Herrick III reminded me of this morning. They mic'd the umpire, which I love. He is talking to the Red Sox catcher, David Ross. This is a great little exchange about his beard. Listen to this.
Doing all right. Look at that beard.
Yeah, right.
You got some gray in that side of a guy.
I don't know what's going to crawl out that on a daily basis, you know?
I don't grow this out too much, because it's very gray.
Well, I don't grow mine out, but these guys, like, we're doing the beard thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I said, hey, I'm going to show my age all of a sudden.
Yeah, I know.
I got fans calling me coach.
Yeah, it's not fair.
No, it's not.
Don't you always wonder what the umpire and the catcher are talking about?
This
during the game.
They were having that conversation at home plate?
Yes, during the game. They don't, Edgar says, I missed this, that Edgar says they mic the ump. They don't play it live because they obviously give something away about the game or some such thing. They record it. They have he's mic'd only, I guess, for the playoffs of the World Series. And they then pick this little segment.
But when were they doing that?
I mean, between pitches or the beginning of an inning. They're talking all the time. If you watch a game closely, which you, I guess, don't do, you can always see the catcher talking either to the batter, talking to the umpire, that sort of thing. 877-301-897. I think Ivan is every man. Ivan said it perfectly.
Okay.
Nothing else matters. And you know why it is? I'm so glad he said what he said. He says they are us. He said they're big behinds. And they're no, it's true. Baseball players are much more like us. You don't see out of shape basketball players.
Or
you don't see
players.
Well, you see some.
Well, they're the middle linebackers.
Somebody. That's
yeah,
but essentially
running backs are in pretty good shape.
But also, even if you weren't a great athlete, and some of us may not have been great athletes when we were younger, everybody could play baseball, even if not terribly well. It is sort of even if the America's sport apparently now in terms of popularity, other than NASCAR, is the National Football League, baseball is sort of the core of who people are.
But you know, remember we had that discussion about the Red Sox and whether people are actually happier when they're winning or happier when they're losing because we sort of can relate to their misery. I mean, that's a weird thing that after the first, when did they win? 2004 was the first time?
Yeah, 4-7.
Okay. And there was that little interim period where you know, people sort of had commiserated with the Red Sox, and the Red Sox losing was their life losing, and you know all the bad things were happening. The Red Sox were happening to them, so now it's all different with their winning again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know, one of the reasons people are particularly into this round, and you know this as well, is they were predicted to go nowhere after a horrible season last season, after a horrible final month in the prior season. The conventional wisdom is the best this team was going to be was 81-81, and they ended up with the best record in the American League, and I think they're the favorites to win the World Series. They're one game away from the World Series.
Judith, I read your email chastising me for not showing enough pride in my
good for her.
Hometown. So
you,
I'm sorry,
you should
Judith.
Be. And you're a local. I'm a transplant.
I
grew up in Fall River. This is your team.
I did. Absolutely.
Let's go.
From my high school that actually went on to the Red Sox.
Who?
A triple team. A guy named Mark Bonback.
Triple A, we
AAA.
Call it.
He played Triple A and the much, you know, in trouble Jerry Remy, his wife, went to my high school.
She did?
Yes, she did.
To Durfee High?
Durfee High School, that's right.
I didn't know that. Mike and Milford, you are next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about how the Red Sox take over everything when they're in play. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I watched the NFL game. And the NFL usually does kill Major League Baseball. I'd be curious to see if it did last night, too. It wasn't a huge game, but...
What do you mean, Thursday Night Football? Thursday Night Football is quite huge, yeah.
So you sound totally uninterested, Mike. What's wrong with you? You're like me.
I never was a baseball fan.
Uh-huh.
I played football.
You play football, okay. Are you excited about football, or are you generally just sort of in an even pitch all the time, Mike?
I'm an even pitch. I mean, I'm excited football's here.
Yeah, I could tell.
What gets you wildly excited, Mike? That's what we want to know. Give us one thing that we can talk about that really gets you going.
That really gets me going.
Yeah.
Football, probably.
I had a feeling that was the answer. Mike, you're a matter-of-fact kind
He's
of guy.
He's a matter-of-fact, low-key kind of guy, Mike. Thank you very much
for
the call.
You know, his blood pressure is probably
very low.
Like 90 over 60. I mean, he's going to live to 120.
Okay. Allie from Braintree, are you obsessed by the Red Sox?
I would rather be doing anything else than watching a baseball game.
Thank
you. Why is that, Allie?
It's so boring. Nine innings, sitting there trying to pay attention. For the first five innings, I'm snoozing in Fenway. I can't even tell you what I'd rather be doing. I grew up in a very sports family. My brother actually played minor league baseball. My dad loves college football, and I would rather be crocheting, and I don't even know how to crochet. It's the most boring sport.
You know, Allie, if you have also kids that play baseball, I mean, my son played baseball, and you have to, of course, go to the games and be a good parent and watch them.
That's even worse.
Oh! They go on and on. You could be there for like 3 hours.
Well, by the way, the part of the problem is, since you're talking about the boredom of baseball, the games are far too long. They're like three hours and 30 minutes. They should be 2 hours and 5 minutes or some such thing.
Yeah.
So, Allie, there's a little hostility in there, don't you think? Are you feeling a little hostility towards...
Allie, you weren't the only girl in your family, were you?
No, I have two boys and two girls in my family. I'm one of five.
Okay.
And like I said, I grew up with my brother playing baseball. He was very, very good. He trained with Roger Clemens.
Whoa. Oh, wow. Oh, big
Did he take performance-enhancing drugs as well or not?
No way.
No, okay. Because the reason I ask that, because sometimes if you're the only girl in the family, they're only girls in the family as I was, your father has to recruit some of his children, to watch sports with him.
Yeah.
And you have to do it.
My boyfriend doesn't. Yeah. My boyfriend doesn't like sports at all, so when we go over to my dad's house, my dad tries to talk to him about sports, and my boyfriend tunes out.
Oh,
so
no.
It's interesting. And the other thing that I wanted to comment on, Marjorie, was your comment about pink hats, which also make me very irate when I see girls with pink jerseys and pink hats. It makes my blood boil. So.
Yeah, me too. Why even bother trying to fake it? You know what I mean?
It's so, silly. Allie, we should write you down as not committed to the Red Sox playoff run. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I just wanted to make that note. Allie, thank you. Let's take one more. I'm stunned. But other than Ivan, who totally gets it, everybody else
I'm not the
is
only
you.
One.
Exactly.
Sherry from New Bedford. Are you obsessed with the Red Sox, or you take it or leave it?
Yeah, I'm the take it or leave it.
Oh, good.
I really think it's a guy thing and a girl thing. And I mean,
well, what's left after that? A guy thing and a girl thing. What else is there?
Well, you know what I mean. Guys are into sports. Totally, as if there's nothing else on the face of this earth.
That's true.
My husband has headphones on. We haven't had a conversation since, you know, I don't know when. I just wave to him, like, you know, do you want something to eat? Or, I'm having a cerebral hemorrhage. Do you care? You know? But honestly, these are just men. They're not anything special. You know, they're just, everybody glorifies the whole thing. Like, you know, there's a lot more important things than that.
You know what you should do? You should maybe feed the husband a Fenway Frank or something and see if you can get his attention back. Sherry, what do you think?
Oh, he doesn't even care about that. But a little side story. Yeah. Ted Williams lived in my in-law's little guest cottage in Lakeville.
Oh, my goodness.
And my mother-in-law was so not into sport that he used to come down and have dinner with them, and they'd be watching baseball, and she'd say, well, you know, like, what are they doing? Like, why is that guy? And how many outs are there? And he'd look at her and say, are you for real, lady? And she was like, yeah, they had no interest in it. So he loved it because he was part of the family. We got pictures of him. They cleaned his little house, and they never bothered him about baseball.
Well, that's
and,
pretty good
there
story,
you go.
Sherry, actually.
Sherry, that's a great call.
Thanks
Thank you very much.
Call.
I have two emails with which
they?
We can end this discussion.
Yep.
One is from Nancy, who says, I am so sick of sports dominating the airwaves. Get up and do something instead of sopping up beer and fat food. And then we have one more from Scott, who says, I would rather be set on fire than watch a baseball game.
Boy, that was unbelievable.
So you see, Jim, I'm not the only one that is a little bit less than wrapped up in this
You'll
whole
be sorry.
Thing. Yeah, I bet there's somebody else, too, we're going to ask about this.
You think you'll go to the parade? Do you think you'll go to the duck boat parade despite your lack of interest in this? You'll be there. Are you kidding me? Yeah, you are. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Are you out of your mind?
Did you go to a duck boat parade in the freezing cold with your son about 10 years ago?
Yes, I did. It was a football game, and he was a rabid fan. And so I went with my son.
What was the temperature that day?
I don't know. It was about 12 degrees. Mm-hmm. It was really, really freezing. That was the first one, when the Patriots won the first Super Bowl. And we were all in the media thing down at City Hall Plaza. And it was freezing. And, of course, there were no porta potties. But I did go to that. I went to the duck boats because I, you know, as a mother, I had to take the children. But
remember the great Tominino line? Gentlemen, start your ducks. Mount your ducks. I totally blew the line.
You
My
blew
apologies.
It, but that's okay,
in any
Jim.
Case, go ahead.
Okay, I'm not the only one. I'm very happy about that. Callie Cross is going to join us in the studio. Just a second. I'm going to ask her. I bet she's with me and not with you, Jim. She's going to go over stories that did not go under the fold this week. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is the uninterested in the Red Sox, Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Krolsky. It airs every Sunday night on this station at 6:30. Callie, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Okay, before we get down to brass tacks here, I have to ask you, Callie Krolsky, I suspect you are with me. Are you, like, rabid about the Red Sox? Are you planning your whole weekend around the game?
No, someone had to explain to me why they were. I thought, don't they play four games? Isn't it over? They're very disgusted with me. So sorry.
You see, not everyone. Is
I bought
swept
her
up.
A Red Sox sweatshirt as a gift. I guess I won't give it to her.
Okay, we have to start because this is my favorite story of like months and months and months. Tell us about Oreos, please.
Oh, this is really interesting, and I guess it's intuitive, not even counterintuitive, and that is that scientists were using rats to just see what their response is to, you know, high fat, high sugar foods. And the one that they thought of was a perfect food is an Oreo. And turns out the rats ate more and more and more of it. And so the scientists said it was, they likened it to an addiction to cocaine. And in fact, they would just keep going and going and going if they didn't take it away from them and withdraw. I mean, this is, now you know. I mean, at least you're not
crazy.
Can't
you see it, though?
Yes, you can see it because you can, you know, you try to eat one and you say, I can eat one. And then the next thing you know.
Okay, here's what I want to know. Do you dip the Oreo into milk or coffee, or do you eat it dry?
I eat it dry, but you, the thing about the study was it turns out the rats take the cookie apart and eat the middle part
okay,
first.
Do you do that?
Sometimes.
Wait a second. You know, I don't understand about this. I understand why scientists use rats in a study if the thing that they are being asked to experiment with is fatal. Why don't they use humans to see that it was either a rice cake or an Oreo? Why can't they use humans in a test to see which the human is more likely to go through it, if everything else is equal?
But they were just trying to figure out the addictive qualities. I mean, they already know that. Well, maybe a few people might go for the rice cake and be addicted to it, but I can't think
who's
of anybody.
Forget that.
You know,
by the way, in this study,
that.
I just read, they literally are saying it's not just like an addiction to cocaine. Yeah. This physiological reaction is like a cocaine addiction.
I have one more question. Mm. The single stuffed or the double stuffed?
Well, see, I think that because the rats are opening up the to go for the cream cheese first, that means that the double stuffed are really, I mean, now you're going toward meth if you're eating that.
I got to go for those. When I get them, it's the double stuffed all the way.
You see the second study where the rats are actually shooting up the stuffing? It's just, they get these little syringes. It's really, amazing.
But honestly, to tell you the truth, you cannot eat one of them. You cannot.
You can't. It's absolutely true. Yeah. Do you put them in milk or coffee?
I don't like milk, as you know.
Oh,
but
I didn't know that.
But I do like them with Oreos.
Yeah, it's just great.
And I've never known anybody who eats an Oreo without dividing it into.
I don't divide it. I dunk it.
You do?
Yeah, I do. And
that's not that it's not good. Yeah. I just happen to like to open it up. I'm like the rats.
Yeah, I think when I was little, I did that because you could. It would last longer that way.
Yeah.
So let's go from the sublime to the not so ridiculous. Yeah. You know, the shutdown is over, and you made a very good point. We were talking before. All the focus was on things like parks and monuments, and by the way, that's very important, particularly for people who travel long distances. But the human impact of this, and I couldn't agree more, it was so underplayed by all of us, other than the federal workers themselves. Fill in a few holes for us, if you would.
You know what was really struck me? I was listening to ABC News correspondent at NPR analyst Cokie Roberts respond to someone who said, well, you know, it was only 2 weeks. And she said, only 2 weeks? She said, do people understand what that means for people? You know, if we're going to admit, and by all accounts, it every time an economist takes a look at how we save or don't save, we're all pretty much living paycheck to paycheck.
No matter what income group
group you're at. So if that be the case, and that's been demonstrated over and over, that 2 weeks is, I mean, it is devastating. I know that's a word that's overused, but it just cannot be stated enough that the people that literally went under, and I don't know if people can reach down in that water and pull them up before they are just and give them CPR. They're under, and we don't see those names and those faces. But one that really struck me during the shutdown, Adrian Walker wrote a
great piece.
I just thought, oh my God, this is exactly what people need to pay attention to. Adrian Walker from The Globe wrote a piece about the government contractors. And by the way, this is not just, he spoke about it with the JFK Library, but it's happening in other facilities across the country as well, or it did happen. There are these people, and they're working for a group, an organization called Work Incorporated. It hires disabled people, gets them back on their feet. They're taxpayers. You know, they're doing all the right stuff. And they do good work. So they're contractors, but they are not government employees. Yet, because the building is shut down, they can't work. And by the way, they don't get back pay because what? They're not government employees. So they're just out of work. And the devastating quote to me from one of the gentlemen was, I'm not unemployed. I'm just not getting paid. I mean, that's ridiculous. He's got a family.
And he focused on this guy that on the day of the marathon, remember we initially thought there was a fire at the JFK Library related to the marathon. This guy had dyslexia and he had a stroke and he had diabetes and he's working and he discovered the fire.
Exactly.
Yeah. And he doesn't, he's not sure if he's going to make up that back pay.
Oh, I can tell you, you're not going to make that. I mean, they're not paying those people. And how do you make it up if you've lost 2 weeks? You know what 2 weeks is? And then the other part of this is that now we've lost $24 billion, $1.5 billion a day for all of these all the people that we're talking about and then every place else in the country. And the thing that has really hit is consumer confidence. So I ask you, if this is coming up again in January, what kind of confidence is there in going through the holiday season where all these other retailers and small businesses are depending on consumers to feel a little bit comfortable that they have something to spend? Because if I'm everybody, and I think I am, I do represent a lot of people, I'm thinking this is coming again. And this time I know it's coming and I know it's going to be further dug in. How much longer? I hope I have something to help me tide go through this.
You know, the $24 billion figure that you cited, the Standard & Poor's figure, calculated based upon the growth rate in America, down to 2% for the quarter rather than 3% because of the shutdown. You know, so many people, you know, what is $24 billion in a multi-trillion dollar economy? And if you do the math, it's $75 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. It's really serious money.
Yeah.
And, you know, even not only was I glad you focused on Adrian's good column, it was called No Fix for the Fix-It Man. If you want to Google it, it was a good piece he wrote on October 7th. But as we said the other day, even though the federal workers knew it was quite likely they're going to get their money back, the people who don't get their money back are the places who people who, as you say, who own the small businesses, were the hundreds of thousands who were laid off or furloughed. Shop. They're not going to go and say, hey, I didn't buy all the groceries I would have bought or all the movies I would have rented or whatever over the last couple of weeks retroactively. So the trickle down impact or the trickle up impact of this was colossal. And how cavalier
some
the vast majority of people in Washington were to the impact of this is just staggering.
And let me put something else on the table.
What?
Salem, Massachusetts. Hello. I got 1 month. They got 1 month, mom and pop shops, to do to make up
the
your
visitor
money
center
for the
was
whole
shut down because there's
year.
Some federal money right in the middle of Halloween season.
There you go. Nobody's coming.
Almost everywhere you turned, there was some sort of impact. And you're right, by the way. Even though the conventional wisdom is in Washington is they're not going to shut down on January 15th. I am sure if you did a poll of the American people, 80% of them would say, of course it's going to happen again. Why wouldn't it? So I'm glad you brought it up. Now, speaking of electoral politics.
Wait a minute. I got to just give you this one statistic, which will just make you grind your teeth. There was a 3% increase in restaurant beverages during the shutdown, primarily liquor. This is from ABC News.
It's actually pretty good.
I just thought I'd let you know that.
Well, people are nervous. People are very worried about it.
And now, Kelly.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Move on.
Show Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Yes. I
fabulous
love that show.
I
and
love
the
that
song.
Show. So do I. I love the song. Yeah. Love the show. Do you think we could be saying, where in the world is Frank Adevinola? Now, do you think anybody listening knows who Frank Adevinola is? Why don't you say who Mr. Adevinola is? I actually interviewed him and two of his Republican colleagues about a week or so.
It was a riveting interview,
No, it was fine. It was a fine interview. But who is he?
He's a Republican nominee. He won in the 5th District. He's
Ed Markey's old seat.
Ed Markey's old seat, and he's now opposing Catherine Clark, who beat six other Democratic nominees, and he beat two others. But
what do you think of what he said on election? And I thought, did you think it was moving or was
it moving all right? Because he was moving around. Apparently, nobody could find him to say, "Well, what do you think?"
You ever heard this before? Ever?
No, I thought that was so bizarre.
Newspapers couldn't contact him. Radio and TV. If you listen, it was bizarre. Woke up the next morning, and I heard that Catherine Clark had won the Democratic primary, and I didn't know who had won the Republican primary. And every news outlet said Frank Adevinola won the race. However, we were unable to contact him. And I assume it was an aberration until you read the newspapers. Nobody contacted the guy. By the way, the great moment about him, and by the way, I've been saying a lot lately, it is really important to have Republicans running in Massachusetts and hopefully some Republicans winning. The night I did a mini debate with the three Republicans, Tom Tierney, Mike Stopa, who was endorsed by Scott Brown, and Adevinola, I was not aware of this. I don't know if you were. Stopa turns to Adevinola and says, Frank, you live in Boston, which is perfectly legal. Secondly, you just came in 18th out of 19 candidates in the citywide council race, 18 out of 19, and now you're running for, but obviously it didn't stop 49% of people in the primary voting for him.
Maybe.
May I say, I tuned in that night. I tuned in as often as I can to Broadside, the news with Jim Brady. And I looked at these three Republicans and I thought, this is a really sad state of affairs. I mean, it's a sad state of affairs because I do think we need to have more Republicans on Beacon Hill. But, boy, if you can't get...
Or in Capitol Hill in this case.
Yeah, Capitol Hill, excuse me. And if you can't get better Republicans than this, it was really... sad.
I just want someone to put out a statement, something, yeah. after
you
won.
Say something, right.
I mean, the other two people must have been mad because they obviously were available to make a comment.
Of course, I should retract that. I don't want more Republicans on Capitol Hill. I want more Republicans on Beacon Hill. And these guys weren't going to do me any good, so forget about it.
Wait a second. Just on that note, you don't think that if a state like Massachusetts, out of our 11 members of Congress, 9 in the House, 2 in the Senate, if there were one or two House members who were moderate Republicans, so that we could have a voice in those caucuses,
well,
to stand up to the people,
you know,
who helped almost bring down this government, that wouldn't be good for the state?
Who would have made a difference, and I did want him to win. I'm not in his district, but I wanted Richard Desai to win because
against
he's
John
a moderate
Tierney.
Gay Republican. And I would have loved to see those people that are so homophobic in a caucus with Richard Desai, who is a great guy and I thought should have won. He didn't, but that would have changed the dynamic, I think, in Washington dramatically.
Now, one of your under-the-radar stories, which has been leaked to Marjorie, she is in love with. Can you tell us what it is, Sunday
night? Oh, this is great.
Well, you know, we use words as journalists, saying people are in battle, they're combating each other, but we mean them metaphorically. So it always catches your attention when it turns from the metaphor to the actual. In this case, in Revere, a local businessman, Charlie Lightbody, who apparently always stays out of sight, kind of low-key, doesn't make a comment on stuff, came out against the casino, Suffolk Downs, and felt so strongly about it that somehow, and the police cannot decipher exactly what happened, they end up in fisticuffs, and he breaks the union boss's nose, and the union boss is in support of the Suffolk Downs casino. So we've moved from metaphor to action, and obviously there's high passions running on each side. I would say what needs to happen is that the clergy who are anti-casino in East Boston should maybe go and lay some hands on some folks.
Yeah, good
and
idea.
Say, chill down. We can disagree, but we can be nice about it.
We have
it.
The two extremes. Frank Abagnale, who cannot be found, and Charlie Lightbody, who is... reminds me, in 1990, when a question was on the ballot by the mythical Barbara Anderson, Citizens for Limited Taxation, and I led the opposition to this. It would have been the largest budget cut, percentage budget cut on the ballot, actually, in U.S. history. One of the things she said at a debate was that this, with the money you could save from this, you could buy an extra pizza or two a week. So the two of us show up at a debate in Newton where there are 2,500 people in the audience.
Wow.
As we get to, this is over a tax ballot question. As we get to the thing, my supporters and her supporters are throwing pizza at each other.
God.
Outside. Literally. They have brought hope and they're tossing with a vengeance pizza at each other outside. And I sort of, no one was punching each other, which was good, but I sort of liked that level.
And nobody's nose was broken.
Well, yeah, and somebody spit in somebody's face,
The police are saying it's a he said, she said situation, but they don't really know. They don't have a timeline for exactly what happened. But obviously, people are very, very, just let you know that this casino issue is very intense for a lot of people on a serious note. I just hadn't seen it,
I want to say one,
to this.
Speaking of a serious note, just in the last 30 seconds here, I've mentioned this to Marty. John Nucci, who I had on with me last night, wrote a great and insightful column about the casino in East Boston, suggesting that winning, the polls show that it's, very close race, winning is not enough to get it there. His point was when the people in Everett voted 86.5% yes on a casino, if the people in Boston only vote 53 or 54%, the Gaming Commission is going to say, wait a second, do we want to give it to a place that's ambivalent at best, or do we give it to a place that wants it? And you add to that fact that Tom Menino is going to be gone, who really wanted it in East Boston. He makes a great point. Unless there is a huge, and in my opinion, I agree with that, a huge margin of victory for the yes on the casino at Suffolk Downs, it's going to Everett, is my guess.
And the problem for Boston, then, is they're going to get none of the benefits.
Exactly.
Very few of the benefits and all the hassles. Yeah.
Right. But there's some strong supporters on the side of the casino, let's not forget, because it's been noted by the folks that would like to place one there. There might be 4,000 jobs now. That can be questioned. But 4,000 jobs, that makes, as several people have said, that makes some difference in their lives. So they have to look at that quite seriously.
But you also think about which town could use the most help.
I know.
Everett could use a lot of help. I mean, they could...
Could East Boston, though.
Well, so could East Boston, but East Boston is contained within Boston, and Everett's just Everett. So, I don't know. It's a tough one.
All around. You know, who wanted it in... I just hate the fact that it's in the city, period.
But I want it located in Connecticut,
it's none of my business.
Okay. Hey, Callie, we'll be listening Sunday night at 6:30. Thanks so much for coming by.
All right, thank you.
And thank you for that great story on the Oreo cookies, Callie. I now know why I have to eat 20 after I eat a single one. Callie is the host of of Under the Radar. And just Jim just said you can catch her every Sunday night at 6:30. But starting next week, it's going to be an hour-long show, which you can tune into at 6 o'clock. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's gone an hour.
When we come back, we're going to look at how a short story, public art intersect by way of the Boston Book Festival going on this weekend. That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
The latest smart device that you didn't know you needed.
So if you're not home and your house is on fire, now you'll know.
David Pogue on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on 89.7 WGBH.
So who will be the next mayor of Boston?
Marty Walsh.
Or John Connolly.
I'm Jim Browdy.
And I'm Marjorie Egan. And I hope you'll join us for the WGBH News mayoral debate.
Tuesday night at 7 on WGBH 2, WGBH Radio, and WGBHnews.org.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Innuendo and Natick, presenting the Hunter Douglas Tis the Season for Style event, featuring Light Rise, Cordless, Duet, Silhouette, and Vignette Shades. Hunter Douglas at Innuendo, innuendo.com. And the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Zander, performing Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony and Prokofiev's Second Piano Concerto with soloist Ju Wong, October 24th, 25th, and 27th, bostonphil.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You may think that the Boston Book Festival is all about the authors. It's not. The One City, One Story is about you, the reader. Joining us to elaborate on this and to assure you that it's not too late to participate is Alicia Anstead. She's the editor of The Writer magazine, co-founding editor of the Harvard Arts blog. She'll be leading the One City, One Story event during the Boston Book Festival tomorrow. Alicia, it's great to see you.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. So before we get to the One City, One Story deal, tell us what this event is about. Who's the audience and who would have a great time if they showed up?
You mean the whole festival?
The whole thing, yes.
The whole festival is 25,000 people who come together because they love one thing, and that is reading. And I should also add writing. They come there because they want to meet the authors who change their lives every day, whose books take them to the beach, who take them to sleep at night, who entertain and illuminate them.
That's wonderful. So how long do you have to wait in line to meet, we had Valerie Plame the other day.
Salman Rushdie.
How long do you have to wait in line, do you think? Depending on the author, obviously.
It really depends on the author. I think the more important part, Marjorie, is that you're in the room with that author, hearing that author speak live about his or her work, you know, that's meaningful to you, and you're there as a community.
So this is an encouraging thing, because we always hear, oh, people aren't reading that much anymore. Is that not so?
Well, I can't believe that that's true. I think people are finding new ways to read. I mean, I read books on my cell phone now when I'm traveling on the subway. So I can't, you know.
With a magnifying glass? What are you doing? I mean, really?
Yeah, I can still read without the magnifying glass, Jim.
Well, listen to these numbers.
Good for you.
Listen to these polling numbers, which I think are troubling, but hopefully events like this help. In a Gallup survey in the summer of 1978, was it 2230, some years ago, 12% of adults said they had not read a book in the previous 12 months. That compares with 22% in a recent Pew survey. And it seems to me, I mean, even though there are many more ways, I think you make a great point that you can read, Alicia, whether it's your phone or your iPad or your Kindle or whatever it is, the reality is reading a book, it to me, seems to be much more of a lost habit or art than it used to be because of all the other media stuff that's around. Isn't that, I mean, and I guess the question that goes with that is, do events like this only lure the hardcore, or do they get people on the periphery who say, well, I'm not a big reader, but I want to meet Valerie Plame. I want to hear Salman Rushdie. I want whatever. I mean, does it attract those kind of people?
I think that it attracts readers for sure. But, you know, Jim, I think that everybody is attracted to a free event about culture in the middle of a city on a beautiful fall day where there are superstars out there. Now, they might not be your blockbuster stars, but there are some of those, too. Salman Rushdie is a superstar in the field. There are 204 writers there tomorrow. And that's amazing. And Boston is such a perfect town for that. But there are book festivals all over this country that attract over 3 days, 75,000 people, 200,000 people. I'm getting ready to go to the Miami Book Festival. It's an incredible immersion.
You mentioned, I mentioned Salman Rushdie twice. You did too. First time I ever interviewed him, he said that one of the things that had gotten people to his books was the role he played as Salman Rushdie. What's the name of that movie?
Bridget Jones. Right,
in the Bridget Jones Diary,
yes,
where he is
great.
A riot, by the way. He is real. And when you read his stuff and you read about him, you say, that's Salman Rushdie doing this comic part. And it said it humanized me for a lot of people. I'm paraphrasing what he said to me. And actually caused a lot of people who'd never read any of my work to start reading it because of a comedy I was in.
Right. So I think it's right to think that people who read are smart, but it's wrong to think that people who read books are only one type of people. You know, there'll be waitresses there, there'll be college professors there, there'll be farmers there, there'll be people just passing by who happen to see an event. You know, culture is culture, and it draws people.
So what is this one city, one story thing that you are all over? What is it?
The one city, one story is a community event that begins with a story that's chosen. It has to be a published story, previously published story, that's chosen by a group of readers and then disseminated 30,000 strong in print throughout the Boston area. It's given away at tea stops. It's at Dunkin' Donuts. It's in libraries. And the community at large reads this story, and then, which this year is a story called Karma by Rishi Reddy, a local part-time lawyer.
She's really talented.
She's very talented.
She
part-time
certainly
lawyer,
is.
Part-time writer, full-time interesting person.
Yeah.
We all come together with her. We'll be doing this tomorrow at 11 o'clock downtown. We come together with her and as a community talk about this story. I do my Oprah thing with a mic in the audience, and we generally talk about how do you read this story? What drew you to this story? What was difficult for you in this story? And then we bring her into the conversation to learn more about her process.
So it's like an all-city read, essentially, is what it is.
It's exactly
right?
what it is.
And so are some people come into this thing? Have you done this in the past?
Yes, this is my third time doing it.
And so do some people show up who just happened upon it, as you said, at a Dunkin' Donuts or at a Subway stop? Literally, you're shaking your head. Yeah,
they sure do.
Well, that's pretty great.
It's
so they
great.
Wouldn't have been there otherwise,
that's,
probably,
well,
were it not for that.
Hard to say. It's not measurable.
Yeah.
But many people come, and I have to tell you that in the two times that I've done this, once with Tom Parada and once with Richard Russo, both amazing authors, the two times I've done it, I have been really moved by how deeply people connect with these stories, read them, and want to talk about them. It's almost like going to mass. You know,
really?
You're with people who all are there not because they share demographics. They're there because they share a love of storytelling.
That's great. So can you play groupie for a second? Who are the people, like this year, for example, who you were dying to get next to, whether you've met them before or not? Who are the one or two you're saying, I got to sneak in there and I really have to meet or talk to so-and-so? Who are they?
Well, I'm really looking forward to Salman Rushdie.
Yeah.
And I'm very loyal to some of our local writers. One of my favorite from the Boston Globe, Jenna Russell,
mm-hmm.
will be there doing her thing. It's such a, 204 authors is an incredible number of people. Alexander Maksik, who has a new book out, I'm interested to meet him. I've read interviews with him and some of his work. He's got new things, lots of new voices here, good representation of the field of all genres. It's not just fiction. It's also poetry, nonfiction, screenwriting, all of that, children's activities, children's authors. It's a all-star event for all these writers.
And just to give people an idea, too, they can hear the author speak. They can actually stand in line and get to meet the author, maybe have their book autographed or buy a new book or something like that. And that's the big thing, to have a chance to actually meet these authors one-on-one. Do you get a chance to ask them any questions? Probably not.
I'm not sure that is exactly the big thing, Marjorie. I think that the big thing is really being in the room with them.
Yeah.
And you may or may not have access to them depending on what deal they have going.
Right.
But It is important that you're in that room. You're with other people who are in that room doing the same thing. It's really the community that's drawn together through this thing we all love, stories.
I so can connect. We had Graham Nash here a couple of weeks ago from Crosby, Stills, Nash. Crosby, Stills, Nash. You know, when you love someone's work, and both of us love his music, love his work, both of us as a solo artist and with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, what you really want to know is, who is he? What is he like in real life? How does he speak when he's not? And I get the same. That's how I felt when I met Rushdie. I was like so intimidated. I couldn't see straight. He was so normal, so funny, so down to earth. And whether he was or not, don't you always want to know what the artists you love, no matter what they're, what they do for a living, what are they really like? I think it's great. I think it's great.
I get to meet Dennis Lehane one time, and I was just beside myself because I get to sit next to him, and he's so talented, and he's a local guy. Although he's moved to the West Coast, I just read.
I thought he's a Brookline guy.
Well, he was, but I think he's just gone west. You would know better than I do, Alicia. I think he has gone west, but he did live in Brookline because we saw the signs all over the place when he lost his dog that was never found. They were everywhere in Brookline.
So one of the things that happens with the One City, One Story event is that Rishi Reddy, who is just an extraordinary writer, her short story Karma reminds me of Russian literature, some of the Russian short stories. You know, there's a tone to it. And immediately when I began talking with her, I wanted to know, how did you get from here to here? Why did you choose this? Were you thinking about that? And that's what this whole event gives us the opportunity to do, to step into a writer's mind and find out how it all comes together. It's not just for readers. Lots of writers will be there, aspiring writers, professional writers. You know, we're all drawn to how did this happen? And, you know, writers can tell you probably the single most frequent question they get asked is, where did you get that idea?
Well, I hope it ends more happily than it begins, because it starts in a very sad situation where you have these two couples together, two brothers, and one of the brothers has done very, very well, and the other brother not so well, and the brother that's done well basically tells the younger brother, he and his wife with their little baby, you've got to move out of the house, and it's just a it draws you right in. I haven't finished it yet, but she's really, right away, you're drawn into the emotion of it, and she's very, very talented. It's a great story, and it's hard. I mean, short stories are hard to
They're
get people
hard.
Into, because people like the novel. I mean, Alice Munro that just won the Nobel Prize, I mean, she is just brilliant. Talk about the Russian, everybody compares her to the Russian, you know, the Chekhov kind of thing, and she's just brilliant, but it's hard to get people drawn into those, but this woman is unbelievably talented.
And you can read this story in less time than it takes those Red Sox to play a
That's
baseball
right.
game.
That is right. You can probably read it in one inning, Jim.
You could probably read Ulysses in the time it takes to read to watch a Red Sox game. Alicia, you've given a great feel for this event. Good luck with it this weekend. Good luck with your forum tomorrow. It really is great to meet you.
Thank you, same.
And congratulations on doing this. And congratulations, not congratulations, but I'm glad you got great weather, because it's supposed to be beautiful tomorrow. It's going to make a big difference.
We hope to see everybody there. Thank you
so much for being here. Alicia Anstead is the editor of the Writer magazine and the co-founding editor of the Harvard Arts blog. And she will be leading the town hall style conversation with this fantastic short story writer, Rishi Reddy, at the One City, One Story event during the Boston Book Festival tomorrow it's in Copley Square, accessible by T. Thank you so much for being here with us. When we come back, Emily Rooney joins us for Open Mic and her famous list of grievances and observations. This is 89.7 WGBH.
Thank you. Same.
Every autumn, Boston Symphony Hall is transformed by a bunch of kids. Celebrate the 15th annual Classical Cartoon Festival at Symphony Hall on Saturday, November 9th. It's hosted by 89.7 sister station WCRB. There will be plenty of games, live music, and your favorite Warner Brothers cartoons on the big screen. Support family entertainment with a gift of $35 to secure four tickets at wgbh.org/cartoonfest.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Atlas Liquors, in business since the end of Prohibition. You can visit Natalie and her brothers in Medford, Quincy, and Roslindale, or you can check Atlas Liquors on Facebook for current offerings of limited releases. And Great Performances, 40th Anniversary Celebration. Itzhak Perlman, Josh Groban, and more perform to honor the program's 40 years on public television. Watch great performances Friday at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as she does every Friday at 1 for Open Mic, is Emily Rooney. The good news, Emily, is the Panda Cam is up and running.
It is.
And no bears have been fatally shot out of trees this week, unless, of course, they have, and the Red Sox have dwarfed the latest bear fatalities. Here she is, Emily Rooney. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
So, Emily, one of your big themes these last few weeks has been that when there's an investigation or a crime involving allegedly a police officer, the police officers or their departments move very, very slowly, or if it's a national thing, to investigate it. Tell us about the ones you've mentioned and one that
I skipped
you left
one
out.
Yeah,
last
tell
week
us about that. I went through this list of things. It just seems to me outrageous that we didn't find out about in a timely manner, or we will never find out again. Of course, we always talk about Ibrahim Todashev, who was shot by, we think, either the FBI or a state trooper in Florida. And where's the outcome of that? And that was in May already. We haven't heard a thing about that. I was also talking about this horrible incident in Carver where an off-duty state trooper ran into the car of these two women. It took 8 days for us to discover that it was a state trooper. And original reports said that the women ran into his car. Of course, that turned out to be totally untrue. Where do we get that information from? And then there was another one, too, involving that awful motorcycle incident in New York City. And it turned out one of the people who was in ended up pounding on the guy's car who was surrounded by these motorcyclists turned out to be an off-duty police officer. It took us 8 days to discover that. But the one that I forgot that I'm really sorry about is the awful case of D.J. Henry, the anniversary. I think it was the third anniversary yesterday of D.J. Henry Jr., who was shot dead by police officers in Mount Pleasant, New York. And the Justice Department is allegedly going to – has been investigating and is allegedly going to issue some kind of a report. Well, where is that? Why does it take so long?
Well, I had the Henrys on last night, and I'm embarrassed to say I had forgotten about the anniversary until you mentioned it in the morning to me, and then I invited Angela and Dan, the parents of DJ, on, and I asked them that question. The two things that bear noting, if you don't remember the history of this, is DJ Henry, then 20 years old at the time, playing football, there's some homecoming team outside a bar there, and he it was a shot by this cop, Aaron Hess. After it happened, one, Aaron Hess, the shooter, the cop, is named Patrolman of the Year by his fellow union members in the Patrolman Benevolence. Talk about
ridiculous.
Grotesque. The DA, in what most people think was a totally half-hearted effort, does not indict, which is almost unheard of in these cases. That was February of 2011. The next day, 2.5 years ago, the Department of Justice said they were going to begin an investigation. 2.5 years. Now, I asked Dan, the father, last night, why, and he says, I'm paraphrasing, the best case scenario is we're now involved in a lawsuit against the two towns. Maybe they're waiting for the depositions. I've never heard
anything
like this.
What's it got to do with that?
2.5 years.
They should be, it's disgusting.
I thought they were conducting their own independent investigation. What's it got to do with depositions and lawsuits? It's about what happened that night.
And can I say, I know this is, it's not atypical. They're two of the finest people I've ever met in my life. And the fact that they cannot even, I'm speaking for myself, not them for sure, that they can't get somebody to take this seriously as it needs to be. And by the way, if you go to djdreamfund.org, you can check out not only the wonderful work they're doing for other kids and their son's name, but it also gives you a little history of the case, which is it's disgraceful.
But you know something? Part of this is our fault in the media, because we have, I think since 9/11, lionized and deified first responders. And they are doing wonderful work. But that doesn't mean when there's some malfeasance, we should not look into it, you know, as members of the media. And many times we don't.
We don't. And Marjorie, that is an excellent point, because even what happened on a couple of days after the marathon bombing, that wild frenzied shootout in Watertown, there's supposed to be a follow. That's another one. There's supposed to be a follow-up report on that about what happened, how many police officers deployed, self-deployed, why there were so many rounds of guns fired. There's nothing.
And you had on Greater Boston an incredible report by our colleague Philip about people that had gotten up from their chair moments before a bullet went through the chair. Because police officers were firing.
Talk
about
nilly.
Not really being anybody in charge and no control. It is incredible.
Where's that report?
I don't know.
Speaking of that report, you know what? We discuss this almost every week, so let's throw it in. You mentioned the name.
Yep.
When are we going to get an FBI report on the shooting, as you mentioned, of Ibrahim Todashev. I think it was in May of this year. What's happened since we spoke last week is the girlfriend of Todashev has been deported by ICE, which we don't really understand. We
Ridiculous.
Think you want her here. That's number one. You interviewed, fabulous interview, with the guy who runs the, is it called Y Crew Gym,
mixed martial arts.
Which is where the Todashevs and how...
And Ibrahim.
Right,
out.
How close to the marathon day had they been there?
3 days earlier they were there, and they had been thrown out because Tamerlan Tsarnaev was really disruptive, refusing to follow the rules of the gym, which are very common in all mixed martial arts gyms. You take off your shoes, there's a certain regimen you go through. He was pushing back and fighting. He had taken, as it turned out, in recent months to praying on the wrestling mats facing Mecca with Ibrahim Todashev. They were both doing that. He had become much more radicalized, much more religious, much more, you know, outspoken. Extreme is the way John Allen from the gym described it.
Well, you know, and the latest...
Crazy, he called it. Todashev was the... That was a great... had a banner week in Greater Boston, Emily.
So the latest incident in here is, I'm sure most of you know, longtime United States Senator from Iowa, Republican Chuck Grassley, who's the... I think he's the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, sends a letter to the FBI, and I'll give you the short version. Either of you will correct me if I'm being unfair, basically saying, how about answering some of our questions? How about letting us know if you had the Tsarnaevs under surveillance before the photographs were released to the public? He says there's some evidence that the FBI was running around Cambridge, where the Tsarnaevs happened to live, before the photographs were released. Why were FBI agents, if that's true, doing it? He even goes so far as to ask the question, and again, I have no idea if there's any basis for this, but a senator is asking the question, were they on your payroll, essentially?
Yes.
Were either of them, the Tsarnaevs, were either of them informants? And while the FBI has denied this, the reason these kinds of questions lie out there is twofold. One, because the FBI, as we've discussed ad nauseum, answers virtually nothing in depth about Todashev or the Tsarnaevs. And secondly, the reason this matters, if the answer to his question about having them under surveillance before the photographs were released is true, if it is true, then Sean Collier at MIT did not have to die.
Yep.
And obviously we know on the six-month anniversary, by the way, of the killing of Sean Collier, a memorial was just put up for in his honor at MIT.
Well, I just wanted to mention, too, along these lines of government refusing to disclose legitimate information, the Herald reported this morning, all these months later, we still do not know whether taxpayers funded a scholarship to UMass Dartmouth for Zohar Tsarnaev. We know that the city of Cambridge gave him a small amount of money. I think it was $2,000, something like that. And we still don't know from the federal end their immigration status, the Social Security number, the money they were getting. This is about whether or not we enabled Tamerlan Tsarnaev, while his wife is working 90 hours a week as a home health aide, to stay home and plot his
right-to-know data blowing.
It is right-to-know. And they keep citing federal privacy laws and state privacy laws. The government is getting more and more secretive in legitimate instances. It's driving me crazy.
By the way, Jim, on your point, I mean, I'm not an extreme conspiracy theorist or anything like that, but I believe in my soul that the government knew who those two were before they put those pictures out, and they were just seeking help in finding them. So when they put out those pictures of them standing along the marathon finish line route, they knew who they were. I really believe that. Now, as for them being on the payroll, that, I think, is lunacy.
Well, is it lunacy that Whitey Bulger was on their payroll?
Yeah, but, I mean, this is
well,
just,
okay, let's forget. Let's go to the one thing that you find to be reasonable.
Yeah.
The reality is, as someone who lives in Cambridge, and I've said before on the air, both of my kids actually were in class with the younger Tsarnaev at middle school. If it turns out the FBI knew the names prior to when they released it, about 1,000 people in Cambridge knew where they lived, and they were everybody knew they lived on Norfolk Street. So by definition, had they been gotten before Thursday, again, I'll say it one more time, Sean Collier would be alive. Now, if it turns out,
I'm saying they didn't know where they were, though. So I'm assuming that they put the pictures out to help try to find them.
I understand.
Hadn't gone home.
Well, yeah, but it seems to me if you know where they live and you have a relative proximity, and we know now that they weren't traveling in some faraway land. And in fact, we had a caller, Marjorie, the day after the marathon bombing, a kid from UMass Dartmouth, and we thought he was making it up.
Great.
Who said he saw the younger Tsarnaev in the gym at UMass Dartmouth
after
The bombing.
It gave him a ride, I thought.
That was another one
that gave him a ride the week before the bombings. And this was an incredible story because he said they just talked about girls and music and nothing at all out of the ordinary. But the kid in the gym, it was confirmed. He was there. Tsarnaev
signed
out
on campus.
So the
point of all this, by the way, is not that any of us are convinced that any of these allegations, which are really troubling, are true. The point of this discussion with Emily almost every week is, give us some information to disabuse us of these concerns if they're not true.
Well,
don't just issue a blanket denial like the FBI did in this case.
We just take it. And I think it's because the only people who gets worked up about this is the news media. Then it's, who cares if the news media can't get this information. But this is really important stuff for everybody, obviously. And I don't get why there isn't more outrage about the government hiding information
from
the taxpayers that are funding everything.
I know. You want to know why? The
Red Sox
are one game away from
World
Series.
Okay.
Now, Emily, we discussed this at the top of the show. The only person who agreed with me was Ivan, the first caller, who is brilliant.
Yeah.
Marjorie and all the other callers, I don't care about this.
No.
It's a dull game. It obscures everything, not just mayor races, right?
Everything that annoys you, everything that's a bum in your life. If you're in the middle of a divorce, if you know you've got health issues, everything stops, including the mayoral race. I mean, it's electric. It's just everywhere.
You listening, Marjorie?
It permeates.
Well, Emily, you know, we got an email from Scott earlier who said he'd rather be set on fire than watch a baseball game.
So not everybody
is in your camp.
No, I feel it all around me. I live downtown, too. I can walk to the park. I just feel like it's just everywhere.
Look at her enthusiasm.
It's okay.
You going Saturday night? I guess the answer is yes to that question.
Well, they haven't set the time of the game yet.
Okay, now, but let's assume it's sometime Saturday.
Season tickets?
I have a press pass.
She's a reporter.
Press pass?
I'm a reporter.
I don't have a press pass. I
don't ask me.
Really? How'd you weasel that, you sly dog, you?
Okay, now, Emily.
That was back when I was the only reporter working for GBH News.
Oh, okay.
Okay, here's the deal. Well, we were glad to discuss all the things we've discussed, as we say every Friday about this time. This is why you're here.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter.
I have absolutely no interest.
I have absolutely no interest. Okay, what do you have?
What I was talking about.
What do you have? It doesn't matter.
All right, I have kind of an eclectic list today that I'm going to kind of blow through here, but I know you're going to be talking about handicap parking coming up next.
Yes,
we are, actually, yes.
This is all I have to say about this. There is way too much handicap parking. We don't need it. It's excessive. It's ridiculous. I don't blame people for I would never do it. Finish your sentence.
You don't blame people for what?
I don't blame people for occasionally parking in one because, you know, there's 30 outside of a CVS. It's just ridiculous. There's way too many. I don't.
They are almost always
empty.
I've
broken some other rules, and I'm going to get to that next, but this is not.
What research have you done to suggest there are too many of them?
I did the research.
What research have you
done? Oh, my gosh. I did. This was a couple years ago, so I'm not be able to recall the subjects, the statistics on it, but the numbers per handicap, there's like you have your choice of 30 spots per person on any given day. It's maybe even higher. The ratio is ridiculous.
Okay,
there's too many.
Thank you.
All right, now I'm continuing with kind of a traffic theme here. You know what skirters are?
Traffic skirters.
So you see that you're getting off the Mass Pike at, say, exit where in New York, 84.
Yes,
and you see a line 2 miles long.
That's right.
Instead of waiting in that line, you skirt it. You go all the way up and you butt in at the last second.
Absolutely.
I've never done that. No, of course I have. But so yesterday, I don't know why I got the biggest kick out of this. There's a cop at the Copley exit off of Storrow Drive. And he's standing there like he's got his arms crossed. And I'm in the exit lane getting off. I was legitimately getting off. But there's a whole stream of cars behind me that were skirting. He stopped and gave them all tickets.
Oh,
I got a biggest kick out of it.
So do I. I didn't know where that story was going.
Yeah,
that is great. Even though I am a skirter, by the way.
Pulled him over.
That is fabulous.
Wow.
Oh, how great is that?
That's a lesson.
So what is the crime?
Don't do it on 84.
Felonious skirting? I mean, what have you done?
What were they giving him a ticket for?
What is the answer to that question?
Cutting in line.
No, but I didn't do the research on that.
Do you feel the same way about someone who has 11 items in the 10-item or less lane at the supermarket?
I'm pretty easy about that.
Okay, fine.
70 items, maybe.
That's a good one. That is a really good one.
Oh, good.
I like that.
I'm glad you like that one. And I have one final one on a traffic thing. And I know you guys talked about this earlier in the week. But
what's that?
Reestablishing the tolls and exits 1 to 6.
We talked about Rich Davies, the Secretary of Transportation.
Ridiculous. I mean, it's like they're going to get 45 cents for some poor guy getting off at
$12 million a year.
It's nothing.
They need the
and
money,
to put
Emily.
Them all back. And
we're broke.
We took them out in 1996. We could have lived with this.
Remember when Bill Weldon, what did he chop them down or hit them with a sledgehammer or something? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Sledgehammer.
All right.
Have you ever been to the head of Charles?
Yes.
All right. How about you?
I've driven by it.
Okay,
I mean,
exactly. It's beautiful. It's lovely. It's a wonderful event.
Lovely.
I mean, the Red Sox are going to trump it. That's fine. But I love having it in town. But I don't get it. I go up there and I watch it, and it's like I never see a race start or stop. I never know who's winning. The boats are going every which way. It's like I don't get it. They never announce who's winning. Sometimes it's four, and they're all, you know, back and
it's beautiful.
I can't follow it.
It's totally beautiful.
I can't follow it either. You're right. You
I have two
look
quick
at people
phenomenons here.
Barley. Okay.
So I saw a drone over the weekend. Have you ever seen one?
No.
I saw a military drone.
Where?
I'm at my house in upstate New York, and I'm out on a lake. My daughter says to me, "What is that?" I said, "What do you mean, what is that?" "It's an airplane." She says, "That is not an airplane. It's coming over the mountains, moving really, really slowly and low." I thought it was like a twin-engine Cessna or something. I said, "You're right. It's shaped like a torpedo. It has these little tiny stub wings and like a propeller on the back. And then it comes over the mountains, and it goes higher and higher, and moving very, very slowly, almost like a flying saucer. It was very cool."
What was the point of that, though? What is in upstate New York?
Emily.
Well, you know, it could be a practice run. It could be photography. It could be almost anything, but it was eerie.
So, I was going to say, it's almost terrifyingly eerie.
Speaking of phenomenon, I have one final one.
Okay, fine.
How many different kinds of these kind of readers do you think exist in the world?
These are these glasses?
Reading glasses.
These are the magnifiers,
and
right?
You can pick them up anywhere in the world.
Overpriced,
how many would you guess?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Hundreds of thousands?
Millions.
All right. I have an identical twin sister.
Yeah.
I picked these up at Whole Foods the other day.
Oh, I like this.
She picked hers up at some little junk shop in Lake George Village. And her husband said, "Those are ugly. Get those." They're the same pair.
That is,
now, come
wow.
on.
That is haunting. That is really.
Do you feel like you can think
that
she's
happened
thinking?
Once before with us. I went to pick her up at an airport, and we are wearing the exact same outfit from Ann Taylor. I mean, we have the same body types and everything, so it's just, but the glasses, now that's, come on.
If I
haunting.
Saw her, could I tell you guys apart?
Yeah.
You could?
Yeah.
So I mean,
we used to look much more alike than we do now. Okay.
Now, Emily, you know, one of the things I admire about you is you do follow up. I say this to Margaret. I love follow up on things that matter.
Yeah.
Here's an issue you raised last week with us. I want you to listen to this, please.
What color is a pumpkin?
Orange, obviously.
Well, obviously it's not orange.
Well, of course it's orange.
What color?
Yellow.
Orange. All right.
It's
the answer is orange. So why in the world? I'm going to really make you think about this.
She's upset.
Exactly.
I can
every
tell.
Year when they weigh in the biggest pumpkin from the patches around, every time the pumpkin is white. What is it?
No, it is whitish. That happens
it's
to be
white.
True. What is that about?
What is that about? What? It's got to be a gourd. It's not a pumpkin.
I have no idea.
Think
you
about
feel
that.
That's like a misrepresentation?
I do.
Where's
totally.
Edgar B. Herwick III in the Curiosity Desk when we need him?
All
well, it's funny.
Right.
That's a perfect question. Where is Edgar B. Herwick
there
III
he
from the Curiosity Desk?
All
he
right,
is right.
You guys.
What
all
are
right.
you doing
what
here,
do you got
Edgar?
For me? Well, as it turns out, this
yes.
is a very interesting question that Emily has raised, and
no
I have tracked down some answers.
I love it.
So
love
let's
theory.
Start a little bit quickly out of the gate with a little bit of pumpkin science. First of all pumpkins are gourds. Okay.
Okay. There
so,
you go.
So you're right there. It is a gourd, and what distinguishes a gourd is that it has a hard stem. So you know, like the stem on a pumpkin is typically very hard.
Yes,
that's what
is.
Makes a gourd different from a squash. A squash has a soft stem. They're both kind of, you know, variations on the same plant, right? Now, pumpkins can be green.
Mm-hmm.
They can be orange. They can be what's called mottled, which is sort of a greenish orangish combination, and they can be cream in color. Okay, so that's kind of the deal with pumpkins. Now, these giant pumpkins, as it turns out, they're not actually gourds or pumpkins at all. They are actually squash, which is sort of an aside. It doesn't really matter. It's the aside. Here's where it gets really interesting. Every single giant pumpkin on the planet, basically, all traces back to one man. That man was named Howard Dill, Nova Scotia farmer. Okay, so they used to have these weigh-offs for years back in county fairs and stuff like that. This guy, Howard Dill, gets really, really competitive, right? And he decides that he's going to get very serious about making very large pumpkins. Okay, so stay with me here. I spoke with Danny Dill, his son, who's still a pumpkin farmer. Here's Danny explaining what his father did a little bit.
Father Howard, he basically taught himself genetics, and he started growing all kinds of these giant pumpkins or squash, what he tried to do was breed something big and orange. And he did that. He created the Atlantic Giant pumpkin, and you did a family tree on mostly, practically every giant pumpkin in the world, it would come back to us, the pumpkin we originally grew here in Nova Scotia.
Now, the best part of him is calling them pumpkins, which is what my grandparents called them.
Totally
I love
good,
that.
Right? So basically, for 18 years, this guy had patented these seeds, and everybody who grows now is growing from his seeds initially, okay? So his were big pumpkins. He was in like the 700-pound range, okay? So Emily made the point that she says all of the pumpkins are white, okay? So I'm going to kill the second sound cut here. I'm just going to tell you that according to Danny Dill, roughly, you're incorrect here, because roughly about 40 to 50% of the pumpkins that win these big weigh-offs are the cream-colored ones, okay? But you are correct. There is a reason why it's happening, okay? Here it is. Here's Danny Dill explaining now with people what they're doing is taking his father's initial seeds, making their own breeds from those seeds, and there's a reason why the cream ones are winning.
What happened was other growers started making their own crosses with other giant pumpkins and whatever, and you had these cream-colored pumpkins. The cream-colored pumpkins tend to weigh heavy. They are thicker than your pretty orange pumpkin. So these guys are trying to grow the heaviest pumpkin to win these awards. It's not a beauty contest. It's for the heaviest.
So I feel totally
vindicated.
Obese pumpkins.
Wait a second. It's pumpkin in the first half of the sentence, and it's pumpkin.
Wait a minute. I feel totally vindicated.
This is exactly right. What the deal is that in each of these kinds of pumpkins, whether they're green or mottled or orange or cream, there's these slight variations. And the cream-colored pumpkins, flesh is thicker.
Got it.
And they weigh more. So what happened is these ultra-competitive people, as they started getting very serious about breeding them, they said, let's breed in these heavy pumpkins with the Atlantic orange giants, and they started making these giant white-colored pumpkins. Now, the reason why, and also to vindicate you, I think one of the reasons why you tend to think
that
all of the winners are white is because around here, some of the biggest fairs, for example, the Topsfield, is like twice or three times world records have been set there. So the people who are most serious about it are making the white pumpkins. That's why the ones around here tend to be heavy on the white pumpkins.
Now, here's the key question. Not only have you vindicated, to use your word, Emily Rooney, you did all this research because of one sentence out of Emily Rooney's mouth last week. Is that correct?
Yeah. I love it. I loved it.
I'm going to do the research next week about the handicap parking. I'm going to get back to you.
Here's another key question, though. I mean, imagine devoting your life to creating the biggest pumpkin.
Don't you love that, though?
Yeah. Wait, I have an answer to this.
What is it?
Let's listen to what Danny Dill here says about
the son of Howard Dill, the
man behind every giant pumpkin. This is what he had to say about why.
What we've done with these giant pumpkins, like we've shipped them all over the world, different parks for different causes, like children's hospitals, or we sent one to the Persian Gulf one year during the Gulf crisis. Our Canadian Armed Forces flew it over, and they had it in a net under a helicopter, and they took it between the U.S. and the Canadian warships as a morale booster.
Wow.
It's just my dad always thought these giant pumpkins is something that makes people happy, get their minds off of whatever, the daily grind of life and stuff they got to deal with.
Now, Marjorie, don't you feel bad?
Yes.
Isn't that beautiful?
I think that's
for questioning
terrific.
His altruism.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
Nova Scotia giant pumpkin farmer and son of Howard Dill, Danny Dill. I mean, this is what this guy does with his life. It's beautiful.
It's wonderful.
Edgar, excellent work. That was terrific,
It was fantastic.
Thank you very much
for that great addition to Emily's list.
What are you doing tonight on Beat the Press? I assume you're doing a pumpkin investigation or pumpkin investigation. What are you doing?
Actually, we're doing a follow-up. Remember the protest here last week? This group, Forecast the Facts, was saying that WGBH Foundation should remove David Koch, the billionaire philanthropist, from its board of trustees because he's a climate change denier and he supports Nova. So we got some pushback from him. We did a segment last week, and I wouldn't say we went easy, but we thought, since he doesn't have any direct influence on the program Nova, what's the harm of having him on the board of trustees? But we got some pushback on that, saying we went too easy, both on the foundation and on David Koch, so we're going to do a follow-up on that.
Terrific.
And then it's the year anniversary of James Foley, who went missing in Syria. He's the Global Post reporter. We talked to Phil Balboni, the head of Global Post, and they're very optimistic that he's still alive. So We're going to revisit that.
Okay. Emily Rooney, thank you so much. Emily,
Edgar
B. Hurt III. That was
guys.
Absolutely
wow. That's what
a fantastic
we do on the Curiosity Desk.
Pumpkin investigation. Emily joins us every Friday at 1 o'clock for open mic. Of course, you can keep up with her weeknights at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston. And tonight, 7 o'clock, Beat the Press. When we come back, we're going to look at a story that will not be dwarfed by the Boston Red Sox. It's about able-bodied people taking handicapped parking spaces they shouldn't take. Are you someone who is getting unfairly blocked out of handicapped parking spots in Boston? That conversation next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I love New York. Virginia is for lovers. Made in Alabama? I guess that's got a ring to it.
It captures the pride that we have, the competitive nature that Alabamians have. We love to win whatever we do.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Alabama's rebranding campaign, y'all. It's next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And four centuries of Massachusetts furniture, where you can see extraordinary furniture made in Massachusetts from the 1600s to the present at museums and cultural institutions throughout the state. Details at fourcenturies.org. And Pure, a member-owned insurer for responsible high-net-worth families, offering resources to help prevent claims and resolve them when they happen. You can learn more at pureinsurance.com. That's pureinsurance.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. A three-week Boston Herald investigation in South Boston has caught dozens of able-bodied people using other people's handicapped placards, parking for free. Joining us on the line is the guy who did the story, Boston Herald reporter Richard Weir. Richard, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, thanks for joining us, Rich. So I'm dying to know, you did this investigation, found lots of people that were using other people or sometimes dead people's handicapped placards in parking when they weren't entitled to. I'm dying to know, when you went up to some of these people, like the Teamsters or the construction crew that was sneaking into these spots or the Westin hotel workers, and you confronted them, Rich Weir, how'd they react?
You know, I was expecting to probably get a little bit more wrath and ire, but a good chunk of the people were just kind of more trembling. You know, we had a video camera rolling and a still photographer, and the folks that they were caught red-handed. They seemed pretty guilty, and they also were fairly squeamish and nervous.
You know, I've known Rachel Caprillion, who's the Registrar of Motor Vehicles, for years since she was a state rep. I've never read her or heard her more outraged. Handicapped placards is in your piece. Abuse is outrageous. To me, there is no fine high enough to discourage people who would pretend to be disabled to get a better parking place. But you go on to say that the maximum fine, which I was actually shocked by, is $1,000 and a 30-day license suspension. Does anyone ever have their license suspended, or does anyone ever get fined $1,000, Richard?
That's exactly. You know, it's interesting you asked that. It's exactly what I'm looking for today. I've put a request into the RMV to get those statistics just to see how widely this is enforced. You know, there was a crackdown that the Inspector General did in 2007, which they covered a lot of a good chunk of fraud. But the problem is just the enforcement of this issue. It is so time-consuming. It's so labor-intensive because you have to sit in these vehicles. And the only time you can actually, challenges them is when they enter or leave their car.
That's a great point.
I just want to be clear, Rich Weir, and great story, by the way, that
Thank
when you.
You
went up to these people, they were pretty much mortified, humiliated.
Trembling, he said.
And apologetic, vowing they'd never do it again. Was that sort of the reaction you got?
To be fair, too, there were some Teamsters who basically just shooed us away and were not very touchy-feely. And, you know, there's some other folks out there that you know, we were planning to try to get as well, but we just didn't have the time to do it all. Kind of limited. We could have done this investigation for 6 months and try to get a lot of people. But,
they didn't threaten to beat you up or anything, did they, Rich Weir?
We didn't counter that. Now, if we kept that, we probably could have gotten some blowback from some of these folks.
Okay, Rich, before we let you go, here's your moment of truth. Emily Rooney was with us a minute ago, said she thinks there are far too many handicapped parking spaces. However, she would never park in one. Here's the question for you. Have you ever, Richard Weir, parked in a handicapped parking space? Raise your right hand when you answer, please.
I have not. It was one of the things. I have a niece that has cerebral palsy, and my family is just, my brother needs that space for his van. They have a lift in it. So I just, having a personal relationship with it, I know I would never do that. It's not that I'm, such a goody two-shoe, but just I wouldn't do it personally because my family has a, relationship with, disabled person. So, yeah.
You're an honorable man, Richard Weir.
But I have to tell you, it's a tempting thing here. You can get one of these placards. Hey, you save yourself, $3,000 a year for parking or having your vehicle.
Because I did not know you can park for free with a handicap placard.
Absolutely. 24/7, 365 a year.
Even at a meter.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Specifically at a meter, yeah. And it's not just even there. I mean, there's even abused people getting handicap placards for their houses in South Boston so they can park right in front of their door. The system is so, people game it so easily.
I can't believe their neighbors don't turn them in because there's a lot of hostility about people scamming the system when it comes to handicap spots. But they
absolutely
don't, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Richard Weir,
thank you
very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for a great piece about all these handicap parking scuff laws, parking in handicapped spots, using the placards sometimes of the dead or their handicapped relatives when they shouldn't do it. Thanks, Rich. 877-301-8970 is our number. 877-301-8970. Okay. I don't think most people go into handicapped spots because they feel too guilty about it, whether they've got someone in the family who's handicapped or not. But Emily brought up a point, that has occurred to me before, that there are many handicapped spots, that there are too many handicapped spots. And what should happen to these people? Should they get a $1,000 fine? Is that enough? Should their license be suspended for 30 days? Should it be suspended for 6 months? I mean, all things handicapped spots.
Well, yes, it goes beyond that. I mean, Emily was saying there are too many handicapped spots designated as handicapped spots. And she said that she had the data a couple of years ago. When you read Rich Weir's piece in your paper, it goes beyond handicapped spots. I was not aware till I read it that if you go to a parking meter and you have a handicapped placard, you don't have to put any money in the meter.
You do not.
So there are actually many more spots available. But the question is not for today, are there too many? Even though if you want to speak to that, it's fine. The question is, would you ever do what Richard Weir would not do, which is park in a handicapped spot? I know a lot of people, let's say friends of mine, who if there are no other spots available and they know they're doing a quick stop, they're just going into the CVS or going to the supermarket, and there's another handicapped spot available, they may put their blinkers on and do it.
Friends of yours, Jim?
Can I say something?
Well,
which friend
would that be?
A friend of mine. Now, let me just say this before we get to the calls. You could say whatever you want, but I want to be clear.
Okay.
I have never, despite what you're going to assert,
okay,
I have never done it. I would never do it. I just wouldn't do it. So
really?
Don't start thinking that
How
I would.
How about fire lanes, Jim?
I parked in a fire lane once outside a Star Market for 30 seconds. And unfortunately, our producer saw me.
That's what they all say. 30 seconds outside a Star Market.
30 seconds. Saw me.
I say those who park in fire lanes park in handicapped spots as well. Of course, only for 30 seconds.
You ever done it?
Handicapped spot?
Yeah.
Never.
And you wouldn't, right? I mean, it's just.
Well, it's because are you kidding? I couldn't bear the humiliation if I parked in a handicapped spot and a person who was handicapped came out and said, what are you doing here?
Well, this is even worse.
I feel
worse.
Very hostile toward people that I see that are able-bodied parking in handicapped spots.
But by the way,
what's
even
worse? Done anything about
what's
it.
Even worse than what we're talking about is an able-bodied person using it is when there's actual fraud, as there is in the piece in the Herald, where some 60-year-old guy is using his father's 90-year-old father's placard. a whole, I mean, you got to read the Herald story. It's a cover story. It's
great
by Rich Weir.
A lot of them are stolen. This Westin hotel worker apologized when he was nailed for parking in this handicapped spot. He was using a placard that had been reported stolen from a legitimately handicapped 54-year-old woman. And one guy who is like 61 has his father-in-law has a legitimate handicap. Yeah, he said he was driving around.
91-year-old father-in-law.
Yeah, and then somebody else had one that was from someone who was dead. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Would you ever park in a handicapped spot or is it a step too far? Emily from Newton, what do you think, Emily?
Well, first, I just want to say how happy I am that you guys are back.
Thank you.
You're on TKK, and it's wonderful to have you again.
Well, you're very nice.
So I have to stop working to listen to you, but whatever. So I will say that a lot of people don't realize just because you don't see someone with a cane or a wheelchair. I have a nephew with Down syndrome, and he can't walk very far. So my brother and his wife have a sticker.
Great point.
And they've definitely gotten looks that people don't understand why they have it. So just to build some awareness. So on the other side of my family, I have a relative who, when my grandfather passed away, she took his sticker and used it until it expired. And I love her, but it definitely diminished her in my eyes.
Did you ever think of turning her in?
Never.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have both sides of the coin in your family. And by the way, I have the same exact feeling that you do about that relative. And it's not kosher. Emily, thank you for calling. Thanks
kosher.
For the welcome back. It's good to talk to you.
Fred,
it isn't kosher. It's hard. It really is. There's certain things. I can't even say what they are. There's certain things that cross the line. This crosses the line.
Well, I think handicapped spots, fire hydrants, and fire lanes cross the line.
By the way, the fire lane thing, let me just say, the fire lane there, it was not a fire lane where if you were parked in it for 30 seconds, you couldn't get around.
Okay.
It was not like a single lane thing. Mm-hmm. It was a huge parking lot.
That's what they all say,
Jim. 30 seconds.
You know, there are these special blue
Maybe
plates
45
that
seconds.
The city of Boston has for a lot of city officials
yeah, sure.
that enables them to park in all these illegal spots. I don't like those either. They should put a stop to those. Hope the next mayor of Boston. We should ask that in the debate, Jim. I'm going to get rid of those blue plate special license plates. Fred and Denham, what do you think about this mess, Fred?
Hello. It's good to be on. Good to hear your voices.
I
would never park in a handicapped parking space, even though I'm highly tempted at times. Because, you know, it's Murphy's Law. You're handicapped, you're driving around, you're looking for a spot, and somebody pulls in one for like 5 minutes, and, you know, there's no cop around, like you were saying. You know, you can only catch somebody going in or coming out. And my main point was during really busy times at, say, CVS, when they're all 30 spots that are empty when Emily's there, and Lorraine are packed. So it's like, you know, I think people are defensive about people getting perks in this town, but, you know, being handicapped and having a handicapped spot is not a perk.
Of course it is not, and I'll pass that along to Emily. But let me say, I worry like you do, Fred. Thanks for the call. Getting caught. Talk about being a scofflaw in a whole number of ways. Getting caught doing certain things, double parking, whatever, is not the end of the world. Getting caught parking in a handicapped spot when you have no right to be there or having a phony placard, the humiliation is just totally up. You know, I just realized, wasn't there a great Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David where he parked in a handicapped spot
yes.
or used the handicapped stall, and he was trying to rationalize it to a person
Got
with
a
disability?
You know, the Herald reports that dozens of Westin Hotel employees were using these placards to people who didn't match the driver's
Isn't
age
Isn't that
agenda.
A polling, by
yeah,
the way?
Yeah, dozens. And at least six Teamsters and this whole construction crew. Obviously, if you're a construction worker, you are not handicapped, and they're getting out with their safety vests, and they're carrying their lunch coolers and all their tool bags, parking their cars and their trucks with handicapped placards, and they walk straight to the job, not handicapped. Let's go to Steve in Lincoln. What do you think, Steve?
Hey, Steve.
Is it Steve?
Yes.
It's at Arlington.
I'm sorry.
It's you. It's you. You're on, Steve. Go ahead.
Great story. My sister was born with a daughter with spina bifida. Her daughter was born with spina bifida, an open spine. That girl has been in and out of surgery many times a year ever since. When she was born, the doctor said, should we plug in a life support or not? Because she probably won't live past two, and she'll be handicapped, and she'll be retarded. They went to every doctor they could. They had a little money. They did everything they could for that girl. She won swimming awards. She was a poster child for the United Way.
Good for her.
She's now 36 years old, and she's still in and out of the hospital. But But my sister, when she found people parked in a handicap space that she needed to get that girl to a doctor's appointment on time or to get some groceries for them or something, she had a pile of stickers that were big stickers that said, stupidity is a handicap, but it doesn't allow you to park here. And she'd just slap it on their windshield so they couldn't see out of it with some really good glue and let them think about it.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Good for your sister. Hey, thank you, Steve, for the call. We appreciate it. Let's take one more, Marjorie.
Let's go to Joni in Worcester. Hi, Joni. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a veteran, and I have three tiny children. And, you know, my disability isn't really visible. I can walk, but it's really painful. So, you know, I just hope that some people occasionally just, you know, cut some people slack, you know, if they're not, you know, actually in a wheelchair.
Well, Joni,
and they're using a handicap placard.
Joni, somebody just emailed and said that the placards should have the picture of the person on them and that you can cover them up with a sleeve or something. I don't know, but do you know about that? Because if your picture were on there, that would solve the problem, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, my picture is on it, with the Massachusetts one at least. But I do use the sleeve because, you know, I don't necessarily want people seeing my face when I'm not in my car and, you know, just more information out there. I don't know.
Hey, is that, Janie?
But I've been harassed.
I was just going to ask you, what's happened to you?
Well, just people coming up and saying, you know, you shouldn't be here. That's really inappropriate. And I'm like, and I just try to, you know, be somewhat diplomatic and say, you know, mind your own business.
Can I tell you something? I'm the kind of person to do that. I'm totally chastened after having spoken to you. Joni, thank you very much for the call.
Well, that's one of the things. You don't know because of there not being many cases a picture. You don't know.
Well, there are also different kinds of disabilities. As Joni just said, some are more apparent than others. And that, we'll continue this maybe with Emily next week when she returns.
What was your disability in the fire lane, Jim?
I was not. It was 30 seconds. Let it go. It's old. It happened years ago. Okay. I was out of there. No harm, no foul.
Okay.
Maybe a minute.
Okay. Coming up next, Chip Flaherty and Michael Flaherty are the brothers behind Walden Media. A lot of great movies. Holes, the Narnia series. We're going to talk to them on our news quiz. It's going to be brother versus brother in a fraternal fight to the death on our Friday news quiz. Stay tuned for that up next.
I'm Adam Riley.
I'm Ibi Caputo.
I'm Philip Martin.
I'm Liz Alessi.
I live here.
And I report here.
They call it the hub. I don't think I really understood what that meant until I got here, but it is. It's a really important city, and it's a really special city.
WGBH.
Boston Public Radio.
So who will be the next mayor of Boston?
Marty Wall.
Conley.
I'm Jim Browdy.
And I'm Marjorie Egan, and I hope you'll join us for the WGBH News mayoral debate.
Tuesday night at 7 on WGBH 2, WGBH Radio, and WGBHnews.org.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Castle Group, PR, digital media, and events partner to businesses that value local connections, international reach, and marketing intelligence, connecting Castle clients with their audiences for 17 years, thecastlegrp.com. And the Boston Conservatory, presenting a special autism-friendly performance of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, providing a safe, sensory-friendly, and judgment-free theater experience for families. bostonconservatory.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It's rather raucous in here. Joining us for our Friday news quiz, it's called the Sibling Rivalry Edition, our brothers Chip and Michael Flaherty. They're the brothers behind Walden Media, the media force behind the Narnia Chronicle films, Holes, and so many great others, including this new Walden Family Theater we're going to talk about. Gentlemen, it's great to see you both.
Oh, thanks, Jim. Great to be here.
Thank you for coming in. So tell people that don't know, because you have made tons of great movies. Tell people about some of the movies Walden Media has made.
Michael, start it off.
Sure. It's mostly based on my wife's fifth grade reading list from St. Peter's in South Boston. When we got funding, we never thought we would get it that far. So in between meetings, I called her. I said, look, he's buying it. What should we make? And she just read the list off, and she said, Charlotte's Web, Narnia, Holes, Because of Winn-Dixie, Bridge to Terabithia, and The Giver, which we just started shooting last Monday in South Africa with, listen to this cast, Jeff Bridges, Meryl Streep, Taylor Swift, Katie Holmes, Alexander Skarsgård, and how thrilled is Jim going to be? The author's from Cambridge.
Whoa, who's the author?
The Giver. Lois Lowry.
Oh, my goodness.
That is one of the great kind of creepy stories of all time. And all the kids have read that in school. I think that was required reading in everybody's list, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's the first of that whole dystopian type literature now that is so huge with Hunger Games and everything else. And we think it's going to be a really big movie. And the nice thing about it is it comes out next August 15th. And 3 days before I turned 50. So I would be curled up in a fetal position if it wasn't for the fact that this movie's coming out.
Hey, you know, you guys, I know you a little bit, and you're a little bit too humble. One of the great things you do, besides make great movies, almost without exception, I shouldn't have said almost without exception, but almost without exception, tell people what you do with school kids and books of these movies when movies come out. Chip, take it away.
Well, early on, I mean, one of the genesis of the whole company was to get kids to read. And we figured out that problem readers, if they connect with the story, will then go back to read the book because they understand the plot line and everything else. So our first movie that we came out with was Holes. And it's kind of funny because we're in the shadow of the Stockyard. And I remember when I first left the AG's office to work at Walden, no one believed I was working for a movie company. So I'd see all these court officers on March 17th, which, of course, is a holiday. And they felt like I needed to be poured into a cab. They were like, Chip, you do not work for a movie company. But Holes was our first movie that came out in 2003. And the book sales went from 400,000 to 1.5 million. So we realized that we were really connecting with kids and making them go back to the original text. And since then, Mike read a great report that said when Harry Potter came out, there were long lines at the library and waiting lists because there weren't enough books. So since then, we have worked with publishers to buy books to fill that need, to take advantage of that demand when kids are into a story.
I love that. Look at the look on Michael Flaherty's face. That's
a real job.
That is just a great. Now, how do you feel about competing against each other? Okay with that or no?
Yeah, well, we homeschool our kids, so if it's on what we taught our kids this week, I think I'll do well.
I'm afraid it's not.
If it's on the Red Sox and current events, I think I'm hosed.
You know, speaking of homeschooling, you did a great movie about schools.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
We did a movie called Waiting for Superman that Davis Guggenheim was wondering one day, the great film director in his own right, both documentaries and fiction films. And he drove by three public schools every day to drop his kid off at a private school. And he realized he was a big supporter of public schools. But what did that say about himself that he didn't believe in them enough to drop his own kid off there? So he did this great documentary, Waiting for Superman, that pretty much showed that we have two school systems, one for people who can afford it and one for people who can't afford it.
Yeah, it was a fantastic documentary, and if you haven't seen it, you should really look at it. It just fits into so much of the school reform that is really starting now. As a matter of fact, it's exciting in Boston. You've got two guys that are running for mayor that are both, I hope, going to be school reformers.
Okay, now let's get into the cutthroat stuff, and then we'll get back to Walden Family Theater, which I am really excited about. You ready for this?
Oh, yeah.
Who do you want to question or interrogate, Marjorie? Who do you want to start with?
Either Chip or
Give Chip a Red Sox question.
Why don't you start with Chip, and then I'll do Michael, so to speak.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You ready, Chip?
Yes.
Okay. This is from an air check earlier this week. Who exactly inspired this man to extemporize with an unlikely word choice?
Unicorns! Show ponies! Where's the beef?
Okay, in case you couldn't tell, he was saying unicorns, show ponies, and where's the beef? You know the
exactly.
answer?
Exactly. Those are my pickup lines when I used to do a singer's line. So, that's Scott Zolak describing Tom Brady's pass with 5 seconds to go to beat the Saints.
Hello?
Wow.
Nice.
That was
somebody
very
give you the questions
impressive.
In advance or
no,
what?
No, I am no Richard Nixon climbing up into the Duke Law Library.
Chip is a sports guy.
That was very good. Okay, go ahead, Jim.
Michael, you're behind by a point to your brother. Are you aware of that?
Okay. It's been that way since July 12th, 1968.
Okay, fine. What happened on that day? Was day he was born?
That's day I was born.
Oh, day you were born. Oh, he's going to be 50. That's right. This is a clip from a press conference from earlier this week. Who is the man behind the mic? I'm sorry for this. And why is this man talking about the Red Sox?
It's humbling. It's great. It's great to be around the players, the great coaching staff, you know, great organization. The players all treat me great. The staff at Fenway treat me great. It's just really a great thing.
Okay, now you didn't want a Red Sox question, but this is the luck of the draw. Who's the guy speaking into the mic, and why is that particular man speaking about the Red Sox, please?
That is our middle brother, Peter Gavin Flaherty, who was a star second baseman at the College of the Holy Cross, talking about what it's like to finally make it to the big leagues.
Is that correct, judges? That is incorrect. Thank you. I'm sorry. Now, Chip, can you steal that question?
I'd love to steal it, but no.
You have no
know.
Idea? Now, let me tell you something, Michael. We've never done this before. We're both very fond of both of you.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to allow you to have a lifeline. And what our producer, Chelsea, has done is she's called a random phone number. We have somebody from Massachusetts on the phone who will try to help. It's Michael Flaherty who didn't. Now, who is it who's on the phone, please? Who's the lifeline, please? You there?
Hey, Jim. This is Peter Flaherty.
Oh, Peter Flaherty. Wait, are you Peter Gavin Flaherty he was just speaking about?
All the 617 ones, they got Peter.
This is unbelievable. Are you related to either of these guys?
I am. I'm the troubled middle child.
The troubled middle child. We did not know you were a standout at the College of the Holy Cross. Good for you, Peter. You should know the answer to this question, though.
Now, Peter, we also know Peter Flaherty, besides being a wonderful person, is a key person in the Scott Brown for Senate era, the Mitt Romney for President era, and now the lifeline to his brother Michael. Do you know
Scott Brown for President era?
Maybe that's possible too. Do you know whose voice that was and why he was talking about the Red Sox?
I do. Yes.
You do?
I do.
Who is it?
I do. He is the he's the Boston police officer who's assigned to the. To the detail in the Boston Red Sox bullpen, who was there when Torrey Hunter tried to catch Ortiz's grand slam in the eighth inning.
Peter Flaherty.
Steve Horgan.
Steve Horgan, that's right. Give Michael the points.
Here's what I want to know. Maybe
thank you. A little
you,
late, but we got
can
it.
Can you
yeah.
tell that Pete's in between campaigns and he's got some time on his
hands? Yeah, he does have time on his hands. But does anybody know how this cop scored this great detail assignment to be in the Red Sox games? I mean, did you have to sign up?
He does every game. No, he does every game.
He does every game, but how did he get it? Does anybody know?
No, we always remember we tried to be ball boys for the Celtics and for the Red Sox.
Didn't work out.
We tried all those jobs.
No,
Pete wanted to be the mayor of Main Street at Disney, and went as far as to go down there and apply for the job. Pete knew the whole hierarchy. You know where you got to start and how you got to build up.
Did he end up being the mayor of whatever?
No,
state?
He never got. No, he that's did. A tough game.
No, that was when back when I thought everything was on the level.
Now, Peter, we're not going to let you go away. What we're going to do is, if your brothers cannot get any questions in the future, we will allow you to give them hints in an effort to get them across the finish line. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, I'll give him hints if I can. Sure.
I need your pistol.
Okay. The next question goes to Chip. Correct?
Ready, Chip?
Yes.
Here's Conan O'Brien. We have bleeped the operative word. What addictive commodity is Conan O'Brien talking about?
A new study claims are as addictive as cocaine. The only difference is when someone's eating in a nightclub bathroom stall, it's really sad. There's nothing slightly sexy about, don't come in! Don't come in here!
Okay. What
I would say Oreos.
You would
Woo!
Say correct.
And, and notwithstanding what Conan said, if you see people crunching them up, that can kind of make it kind of cool. So, yeah.
Is that what you do? Do you crunch them up?
On occasion.
Yeah.
You know, late at night.
Do you notice Chip's got a long pinky nail for sniff the Oreos?
Do you dip them in milk or coffee?
No, I don't commingle at all because I think that just leads to problems in your personal
worlds
life.
Collide.
I keep things separate. Yeah.
Okay.
I like your style,
right, thank
Chip.
You.
Okay, you don't need help from your brother Peter, who's still there. Let's go to Michael. This is for you. This man is making a victory speech. I don't think your brother was working on the campaign. Who is he?
Cory Booker.
And what? This is unbelievable, you two. Let's hear the sound from him anyway because it's a good speech. Here he is on election night.
Thank you, everybody. All right. Well, this is an extraordinary night, and I want to thank everybody. On one of my last days as mayor of one of our state's greatest cities, I want to thank the people of this city for putting your faith in me.
And what city was he mayor of? That was the second half of the question. I forgot.
Michael.
Newark is exactly right. Give him a point.
It was 35-point lead, knocked down to 10.3, and if Pete ran the campaign... he wouldn't have won, but he's a great ed reformer.
I was going to ask you, Peter. He is? Cory Booker is?
He's fantastic.
Great. Very much.
Peter Flaherty, I was wondering, because you're a political guy, what do you think, what does Cory Booker's future look like to you as a politician?
Well, I mean, Booker is, it's funny because Deval Patrick, who I think still has a future in politics.
Very
at least,
talented.
The State House. Has been mistaken for Cory Booker, although Cory is a lot taller than Deval. Cory is 6'3".
a lot of people don't realize Corey actually was an All-American high school football player. He was a tight end at Stanford. Yeah, he played tight end at Stanford.
Wow. Well, by the way, Deval Patrick, when he was here last month, told us the story of being at the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and a woman running up to him and saying, "Oh, my God, Cory Booker." And he said, "No, I'm not." And she said, "Yes, you are."
That could be a problem for Deval because Deval is not tall and Cory Booker is 6'3".
That is exactly.
So, I mean, but he's a very talented guy.
And a vegetarian.
Yeah, Booker's very talented, and he knows how to get press. I remember he did a 10-day hunger strike to draw attention to open-air drug dealing in Newark during his.
Hey,
during
Peter,
his
what is this, a filibuster? You're not even in the quiz, Peter.
But there's a great documentary when Cory Booker
this
first
is Michael
ran
Flaherty
for mayor against sort of a.
Street Fight, it was called,
industry,
our producer tells us.
Yeah,
Street Fight.
It was fantastic. You have to see it.
Okay,
hey,
what's
the score after two rounds with the Lifeline assistance of Michael Gotti? 3-1.5. Who's winning?
I
assume Chip
for
is
the
winning.
Oreo,
thank you.
Layup.
Hey, before we go ahead, Chip, so you're ahead 3-1.5. Before we go ahead, this we read front page Globe story by the great Sarah Rodman, whom we love, about Walden Family Theater, Michael. Well, tell us what this is. I think it's a fabulous project. What is it?
The idea with it's so hard now to make feature films because they cost at least 40 to make and at least 40 to advertise. So we wanted to find a way to make more movies, and so we have lower budgets. And the idea is to make films based on great books. And we took my brother Peter out of entertainment retirement. Peter used to work for us at Walden Media. He was one of the guys right there at the beginning for us and ran marketing and all kinds of other things. And so Peter's done a great job with our most recent one, Watson's Go to Birmingham. And just last week, we had something at the Chicago Institute of Politics, which was amazing. It was David Axelrod, one of the sons of the Little Rock Nine people. And afterwards, I just got to sit back and listen to and Tanya Lee, Spike's wife, who produced it, and Nika, who was the star of it, has won a couple Tonys. We all just got to sit back and hear Pete and David Axelrod trade campaign war stories. It was one of the best out-of-body experiences
of my life. And for those
who
don't know, I'm assuming virtually everybody does, David Axelrod,
was
key
Obama's
advisor to Obama, and Peter Flaherty, their brother, a key advisor to Mitt Romney. I hope the answer to this is yes, Chip Flaherty. There's an audience for this, right? I mean, there is an audience for a movie you can actually sit down with your kids or your parents and watch and everybody enjoy from all different perspectives,
There definitely is. And the question, like Mike said, with the high price of theatrical production and release now, you just have to fish where the fish are. You have to figure out where families are viewing, what are their consumption habits, and how you can do it. Because, you know, it's funny. I was doing a radio show once promoting one of our movies, and I talked about the collective viewing experience. And I said, there's nothing sadder than segmentation. You stopped at a red light. You look in a house, and you see one TV and, you know, the teenage boys watching ESPN, the mom's watching a cooking show, the boys watching the Disney Channel, and there's not that collective experience. And I thought it was very moving, and then the radio host was like, "What are you, a pervert, looking in people's windows?" So he completely killed the metaphor.
What was the answer to that question?
I said, well, as a former assistant DA, it was in plain sight. I didn't need a warrant, and I could look in the window.
And these are on the Hallmark Channel, is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
It's a fabulous project. And is it every Friday? How often are these things on?
Just about every Friday night, yeah.
Friday night. There's also library films and some of the films that we've made before, Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium and some other ones. And then we're hoping to kick it off again in 2014.
You know what I wonder? Are families going to the movies that much anymore? I would suspect a lot of them.
You mean as a family?
As opposed to being at home and watching things, you know, either through Netflix or whatever on the television screen. Do people actually go to the theaters with their kids?
Yeah, I think they are, and it's just it's kind of like the Parker Brothers 8-88. Mm-hmm. I mean, when the family goes, they have to find a movie that kind of suits them all. So you see a lot of big action, you see a lot of animation, and something that can kind of fit and feed that whole family. So you have to make that adjustment, number one. And number two, as things begin to migrate online, you have to figure out how to find those eyeballs too.
Yeah, we should say, by the way, not only have you guys achieved great things, I should say that everybody feels wonderful about it. They're local kids. We should say the Flaherty brothers are from Arlington, right? Is it Arlington boys? Okay, let's go back to the quiz question.
Went to high school in Cambridge, though, Jim, if that can give me an extra point.
I'm full of it. In my book, it surely does, Michael. Next question for Chip from Marjorie.
Okay, where am I?
That's a good question. Who am I and why am I here?
That's a hard question.
Stockdale.
I'm at the newly minted Bostonian, I think.
I think you are, yes.
Okay. Chip, here is a newly minted Bostonian. In this clip, he's talking about something he can do that his older predecessor could not.
Well, I'm quite young. I'm still able to dance on stage.
Do you know who that is?
Baryshnikov? I have no idea.
This is a tough one.
How about you, Michael?
Any hints?
Well, actually, we got there's a man who can give you a hint. Here he is.
Peter
Flaherty. Peter, I'm buying you time while you can see if there's
anybody
Google
idea,
that.
Peter?
Brother, can you give a hint to your brother, Chip, please, Peter?
Yeah, Chip, I do know this one. Let me try to. He will probably, you could see him hanging out with Keith Lockhart on occasion.
Very good clue. How about that, Chip? No more. That's plenty. How about that? Do you have any idea? Don't look at your brother, Chip. Answer yourself. Peter's helping out.
We have a very collaborative workplace.
Yeah, exactly.
It's triumvirate.
So, Michael, can you steal the question based upon your brother Peter's a clue? Give him one more hint.
He's maxed out my symphony knowledge there. I know Seiji Ozawa.
Yeah, that's one of his predecessors, James, and it's not James Levine. That's another one of his predecessors, and it's not Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You have no idea these two. Okay, who is it, Peter Flaherty? Tell your brothers. Peter. Peter's gone. Andris Nelsons is who it is. I get the points because I apparently do. Now, Michael, here's your question. That was rather embarrassing right there. Now, here it is. This local made a blip in this week's news cycle with an announcement. We're going to play you a clip of him and ask you the question on the other side. Just listen.
A friend of mine once told me that plans are like these wonderful sunsets. You can gaze at them and enjoy them, but at some point, it goes dark.
That's exactly right. So what ambitions did this particular man let fade to black this week, Michael Flaherty, please?
That was the guy that successfully kicked his Oreo addiction.
That's exactly right. Now, that would be wrong, Michael Flaherty. Chip, do you have any idea what it is?
I have no idea.
That's
no
a tough one. That's a tough one.
Okay, Peter, you're back again. Are you on the phone still, Peter?
I am. I'm back on. Sorry, I got cut off.
Can you give a hint to Michael on this one?
Chip, this is for Mike.
No, pistols.
It's the other brother. I know. It's hard to tell
Mike,
him apart.
I'm surprised. Mike delves into a lot of these local political races. I'm surprised. He's a Somerville guy. He did not go to Matignon, though.
Capuano?
Oh, this is bad.
Nope, very close. He sounds a lot like Aristotle, but he's not.
Darn it.
Okay, Chip, do you have any idea based on this?
Plato?
Tell him who it is, Peter. Who is it, Peter?
Joe Curtatone.
Oh. Joe Curtatone.
That was a good one because I know him and I've interviewed him and I didn't recognize his voice.
Okay, this is the last question. Here's the deal. How much is Chip ahead of Michael, please, Chelsea? Okay, still 3-1.5. If you get this right...
Chelsea, you gave him the Oreo?
If you get this right, you win. And if you get this wrong, Chip, you lose. You ready for this? This woman had an outburst earlier this week. Have a listen and tell us where this happened, please.
He will not be mocked. He will not be mocked.
Don't touch me.
He will not be mocked. The greatest deception here is this is not one nation under God. It never was. Had it been, it would not have been...
Okay, who is she and where did that particular outburst happen? Chip Flaherty, please. You win if you get it right. You lose if you get it wrong.
I was hoping it was the woman at the Apple store. But then when she invoked the Almighty, I figured it wasn't. So I have no guess.
Oh, my God. Do you have any idea?
No.
Okay, you can't give a clue this time, Peter. You have to give the answer. Do you know what it is?
I know the answer, yep.
What is the answer?
It's the woman, it's the stenographer from the house, Diane Reedy.
How come he's not
you
playing
are
this quiz?
No, look, you know, he's the star of the family. He humors us and lets us do these things.
Hey, Flaherty Brothers.
What's up? Click on the Drudge Report enough.
Hey, gentlemen, before you go, if people want to get a schedule of this Walden Family Theater thing that you've started on the Hallmark Channel, how do they find out what's on and what?
Walden.com or on the HallmarkChannel.com.
It's fabulous. Hey, Peter, thanks for being a lifeline. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks so much, you guys.
Love you, Pete. Thanks, Pistol.
And I love you, too, actually. He's a wonderful soul.
He is very impressive on those.
Chip and Michael, it's great to see you. Congratulations on the Walden Family Theater thing. We hope to see you soon.
Thank you both for coming in. Congratulations on your great work. You do fantastic. The films are just fantastic. Chip Flaherty and Michael Flaherty are the brothers behind the people that the company that makes those films, Walden Media. And, again, to see what they've done and what they're up to, go to walden.com. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Radio. Tune in Monday. We're going to have Ray Flynn in here to talk about the mayor's race. On Tuesday, Jim and I are moderating a debate between the guys who would like to be the mayor of the city of Boston, Marty Walsh, and John Conley. So please watch us. And thank you for listening to us today. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And by the way, the debate is Tuesday at 7 o'clock on radio and TV.
Oh, thank you.
I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Sorry, I forgot to mention the time. Thank you for listening.